This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Nicole Maines, was the first transsexual youth to win a discrimination lawsuit. She's one of 11 people featured in the new HBO documentary, The Trans List, which premiered earlier this month. It profiles trans men and women from a variety of professions, including Army sergeant, lawyer, and porn star. A couple of celebrities are included, too, Laverne Cox and Caitlyn Jenner. A companion book, also called The Trans List, includes photographic portraits and profiles of the people in the documentary, as well as other trans men and women. The photos are taken by Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who also directed the film. Our guest, Nicole Maines, is an identical twin, but unlike her twin brother, never identified as a boy from as far back as she can remember. It was difficult for her parents to comprehend, but they eventually understood this wasn't a passing phase and became her advocates and defenders. When Nicole was in junior high, her parents, on her behalf, sued her school district in Maine after her school prevented her from using the girls' bathroom and required her to use a staff bathroom instead. She won on appeal in the state Supreme Court. Nicole's now a 19-year-old college student. Terry Gross also spoke with her parents last year after a book about the family was published.
Nicole Maines, welcome to Fresh Air. So my understanding is you always felt that you should be a girl, even though you were born in a boy's body. Give us a sense of what it's like to be like 1 year old or 2 years old and have this sense that your gender is actually different from the gender of the body you're in.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's very confusing. I would say that, you know, the interesting thing about me in particular is that I have an identical twin brother, and I realized my own gender at the same age that he did. The only difference was that there was some disconnect between my body and what I felt like, you know, should be right.
So when he realized his gender and you realized yours, did you start heading in divergent directions in terms of what you wanted to wear, what you wanted to play with?
Yeah, well, you know, the examples that we use are of pretty gendered things because we live in a very gendered society. So I was always very attracted to, you know, pink and dresses and Disney princess movies. And I always wanted to play with Barbies rather than action figures. And so I was very drawn towards those more gendered things towards females, while all at the same time feeling like my body wasn't right and that at some point, you know, something magical was going to happen and that it all, you know, sort of fix itself. And that didn't come.
Your mother says that when you were two, you asked her, "When do I get to be a girl?"
Yeah.
Did you think that something was going to turn you into a girl?
Yeah. By the time I was like five or six, I sort of, you know, I guess I'd assumed that the medical world had advanced so much that there must be some kind of surgery that was going to fix me. So, you know, I'd start asking my mom and telling people, "Oh, when I grow up, I'm going to get plastic surgery to make me a girl."
You must have been very convincing as a little girl because your parents weren't attuned to the trans community and to trans issues.
Yeah.
I think when you started identifying as female, they were in like uncharted waters.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's funny that you say trans community because the trans community there was very, very low visibility for that community. And so it was really, really hard for anyone, you know, trying to find information on what, you know, being transgender was. It was near impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like uncharted waters is an understatement.
So how old were you when you started dressing like a girl? And I'm not even sure what you were wearing because in some ways, so many people are just dressing like pretty gender neutral clothes, you know, like jeans, corduroy pants, t-shirt, you know, blazer. It could be, you know, they're cut differently, but basically the outfit could be worn by a boy or a girl.
Yeah, I think it depends on whether or not we're considering publicly or at the house, because I'd been dressing up in girls, quote unquote, girls' clothes since I was three or four. Anytime, you know, I would play dress up, I wanted to be like Dorothy or Cinderella. But I started wearing girls' clothes around second, third grade when we started trying to make my transition public.
So you had friends who knew you as a boy and suddenly you started coming to school dressed as a girl?
No, not really. What had happened was we worked with the school and decided that we'd try to make the transition gradual. And so that started with, you know, like you said, wearing more gender neutral, androgynous clothing that would like be pink, and then growing my hair out, wearing more obviously female clothing. And then that moved into skirts, ear piercings, and, you know, a new name.
So did your friends at school change when your gender started to change publicly?
No, not at all. I was actually a little surprising. And I think part of it was that, you know, kids and just young people in general are usually a lot more, I guess, open-minded to change, especially when, you know, you're like really little in elementary school. You don't expect a lot of things from people. So if somebody says, I'm switching genders, you're just sort of like, okay, that's new, but cool. And I think it also, the other thing that helped was that we did make the transition gradual and they were sort of eased into it with me. So, you know, it didn't come as just one big shock someday and everyone's just sort of had to process that.
So you had a twin brother. So as you were becoming more and more female, he was, you know, growing more and more into being a growing boy.
Yeah.
So when you looked at him, you saw your mirror image, except not exactly. You saw what you were, you know, in quotes, supposed to be, as opposed to what you were. So what was that like for you in the sense of watching your identical twin become more and more of, you know, of a boy, especially as he started approaching puberty and you started approaching puberty?
Yeah. Well, fortunately for hormone blockers, which, you know, having supportive parents was really, really helpful because, you know, we were able to work and get me on the medication that I needed so I could avoid puberty and going through that alongside my brother. So after, you know, we halted that for me and then watching him just move forward and, you know, just watching testosterone work its wonders, it was terrifying. But at the same, because, you know, it was one of those things that it felt like, wow, that could have been me. But at the same time, that could have been me. And it felt like I dodged a bullet.
So I want to ask you about the bathroom issue, because you and your parents actually sued your junior high school and won, because at some point, because of a protest by a grandparent, the school prevented you from using the girls' bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after you had transitioned from male to female.
Correct.
So let's talk about what happened to you. A boy followed you into the girls' bathroom and he bullied you. What happened that precipitated your lawsuit?
So, like I said, one of the things that helped kids come around to my gender identity was easing them into my transition alongside me. But I think something that we hadn't taken into account was what would happen should a student transfer into the school or move to our school district over the summer. A new student had come and, you know, he hadn't really been there for my transition. And so he didn't know me. And he ended up telling his grandfather that I was trans. And his grandfather was part of a special interest group. And
what do you mean by special interest group?
He didn't think that my using the girls' bathroom was very okay. So, you know, not liking a quote-unquote boy using the girls' room, following sound logic, he thought it made sense to send a boy into the girls' room. And so the grandson followed me in on...
Are you saying that... let me stop you for a second. I'm sorry. Are you saying that the grandfather suggested that the boy follow you into the girls' room?
Yeah. So basically, he told his grandson, you know, this isn't okay what this kid's doing, so you have to sort of make a statement and follow this kid into the bathroom to, you know, make some kind of point.
And what happened after he followed you in?
Well, he just sort of like looked at me. he has this look on his face, and I don't really know how to describe it. But he just said, you know, my grandpappy says we don't have to have any faggots in our school. And, you know, then the teacher walks in all red in the face. And I swear to God, like, his feet did not touch the floor. Like, she dragged him out of the girls' room. But, you know, then after meetings with guidance counselors and principals, I guess the school had been threatened by this special interest group that the grandfather was a part of, that they would sue if I kept using the girls' room because it was, you know, an infringement of some kind of right of theirs. So they pulled me out of the girls' room, and they decided that it'd be much less trouble if I just used the private staff bathroom away from all the other girls.
So did going to the bathroom become like an upsetting issue for you, or did you just accept, well, you know, this is the way it has to be, so I'll just do it?
For a while, I tried to sort of get used to it. And, you know, I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. Because, you know, they sort of, the teachers, when they told me about it, they sort of tried to talk it up. And they were like, oh my gosh, there's like, you'll have your own mirror where you can, you know, sort of like primp in. And of course, it was an adult bathroom. And being in fifth grade, this mirror was much too high for me. And so I felt, you know, a little tricked.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to sort of just end up feeling lonely. And it made me feel like I was an other. And yeah, it just got lonely. And, you know, after a while of listening to my parents sort of talk about how unfair it was, you know, that I was being punished, you know, I sort of tuned in. I was like, wait, yeah, why am I being punished? So I decided that I'd start using the girls' bathroom again. And no one thought anything of it. My friends were like, oh, good, you're back. And I'm pretty sure the teachers knew that I was using the girls' bathroom again, but they didn't say anything because my teachers were really good. And they were the ones who had seen me every day and watched me transition. And so they knew which bathroom I should be in also. So no one really said anything.
So it worked out when you started using the girls' bathroom again?
Yeah, no one said anything. No one was doing anything. We were all just sort of like, oh, good, things are back to normal. And then after a couple months of that, I got followed into the bathroom again. And once again, I found myself in the principal's office being told that I was going back into the staff bathroom.
And what happened? Were you on your own to decide? Did they trust you to use it?
Oh, no, I got a bodyguard. No, I got what they called it was the Eyes On program.
The program?
Bodyguard. I basically ended up getting a specially assigned adult to follow 10 feet behind me at all times, make sure that I use the isolation chamber bathroom. And they said it was for my own protection. It was to make sure I was using the bathroom.
So this person followed you around through the halls, whether you're going to the bathroom or not.
Yep.
So whose idea was it to sue? Did your parents suggest that?
Yeah, it was my parents. I mean, I was like in sixth grade at that point. So I wasn't like, you know what? Let's sue. No, my parents, they knew that what was happening wasn't right and something had to be done about it.
So how did you feel in middle school about suing?
I felt great about it. It finally felt like people were doing something. You know, for the past 2 years using staff and gender neutral private just for Nicole bathrooms and having a bodyguard follow you around all the time, it felt really, really good to know that people were finally doing something about it.
So it was
annoying. I would get up to go to class to, you know, just go to the bathroom, and my teacher would have to stop me in front of everybody and tell me to wait for whoever was following me that day. It was really, really humiliating. So it felt really good to know that my parents recognized what was happening and knew that it was wrong.
Did you always feel like when you went to a public bathroom, for instance, or when you did go to the girls' bathroom in your school, that you were in a stall and therefore like protected from anybody kind of seeing you or from anybody else fearing that you would see them?
No, especially in schools, before that whole staff business happened, I felt totally comfortable using the girls' bathroom, and all the girls felt totally comfortable with me. No one was, you know, afraid of me peeping in on them or them peeping in on me to see, oh my gosh, what's really under Nicole's pants? I mean, these are the girls who had sleepovers at my house. We've all, you know, we all had sleepovers. We'd known each other since first grade, and we had all been there for each other for various other things. And so bathrooms weren't something that we felt threatened by or was even something on our minds. And I think that's something that's been completely fabricated, to be completely honest. This entire issue of transgender people posing a kind of threat to cisgender women in bathrooms is made up. We are just like everybody else. We go into the bathroom, we keep our heads down, we don't look at anybody. We're not there to, you know, look at you. We're minding our own business.
So you and your parents sued on the grounds of the State of Maine Human Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
For singling out for exclusion from the restroom a trans person like you just because you're trans. So
yep.
This was a wrongful discrimination suit based
exactly.
on gender. And after about 6 years, the court ruled in your favor. It went as high as the state Supreme Court. So in 2014, you became the first trans youth to win a court decision pertaining to being trans.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty remarkable for you.
It was weird. Well, I mean, the whole situation was weird, being in a lawsuit for 6 years. After we'd filed suit, obviously we couldn't stay in the Orono School District. So my brother, Jonas, and my mom and I all moved down to Portland.
And we moved to a different place in Maine. Was that because you wanted to start at a different school?
Yeah, we just needed a fresh start. All the schools around there knew what the situation was, and there had been a lot of negative media attention surrounding mm-hmm. it. And so we just needed to go somewhere where that wasn't something that was being actively discussed. A fresh start. So we went down to Portland, and I went back in the closet.
Oh, how deep in the closet did you have to go?
Deep. Deep. Like, walk-in closet. Like, it was deep.
So were you closeted as trans but still identifying as female and dressing as female?
Yeah.
But no one knew you were trans?
No one knew.
Was it hard for you to have friends?
Absolutely. Well, since first grade, it'd been part of my introduction. I just sort of walk up to people and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Wyatt. I'm a boy who wants to be a girl," or "I'm a girl trapped in a boy's body. Someday I'm going to get plastic surgery to make me a girl." It was something that just sort of came with, "Hi, what's your name?" And, you know, first, second grade, no one thought of it. And as years went by, I stopped having to come out to people because it was such a small school. And so it was really hard to form connections with people because that had been such a relevant part of my life for the past few years. So I just shut down. I did not do a lot of extracurriculars. I didn't have people over. I definitely didn't go over to anybody's house. No sleepovers anymore. It was just go to school, go home.
So I don't know if you have an answer for this or not, but, you know, President Obama has supported trans rights.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump has not ever been in office, so we don't know. He has no, like, policy track record. But Vice President-elect Pence has, you know, basically been seen as an opponent of LGBTQ rights.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, you know, as someone who is in college now, you're a sophomore in college, how much do you think the tone of the administration affects how people treat you and how they see you? Now, I mean, you've only known really the Obama administration because you're 19 and he's been in office for 8 years.
Yeah.
So well, you don't really have anything to compare it to.
Even though, you know, there wasn't a lot to compare it to before President Obama, I still saw the change. And his support was so important for the transgender and the rest of the LGBTQ community, because it showed us that, you know, it felt like for the first time our government was really, really on our side. And it felt like real federal steps were being taken to normalize and include our community within the rest of the country. And just the amount of allies within America just skyrocketed. So many more places in this country became a safe space. And since the election, thank God, me personally, I haven't been subject to any sort of change or tone within my college community. I mean, except maybe for the fact that a couple of us are a lot sadder now, because it's a scary time. But, you know, it's one of those times where it's a wake-up call. I think that some of us were starting to, you know, sort of get comfy and take our shoes off. And the universe's way of saying, oh, you've got your shoes off? Good. Here, put these work boots on because there's more work to do. So, you know, it's just rally the troops.
Can I ask you a kind of superficial question, which I imagine doesn't feel superficial? It's just like, how do you dress now? You know, in one sense, that's a kind of shallow question to ask. On the other hand,
oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, when you're not allowed to dress a certain way, how your dress takes on extra special meaning.
So, yeah, for real. I totally know what you mean.
Right. So
for so long when, you know, your gender is super policed.
Exactly. Right.
There is an incredible liberty, you know, when you get to dress yourself. And there was a time when I was little where I would have been appalled if someone tried to drag me into the men's section. I am currently wearing... Actually, both my pants and my shirt are from the men's aisle. My pants, because I just came here from the university. I had sculpture, and it is impossible to find women's pants that are 100% cotton because everything has spandex now, and I needed something that's not going to light on fire. So that's why I'm wearing men's pants. They also hug my hips really nice. And then my shirt is just something I picked up at the men's racks at Hot Topic because it had a character I liked on it. So, yeah, it's really, like, strange how my style has sort of changed in that sense. But at the same time, it's kind of like I'm back, but I'm back on my own terms.
Yes, exactly.
Nice. I'm going to make the men's aisle work for me.
Nicole, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Nicole Maines is one of the transgender people profiled in the new HBO documentary, The Trans List, which premiered earlier this month. Now we'll hear from Fresh Air contributor Sarah Heppala. The holidays are a stressful time for everyone, but especially people who are trying to quit drinking. Sarah remembers how hard her first year without alcohol was. She's the author of the memoir Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget.
Back when I was drinking, I loved the holiday season because it was a time of year when getting blasted was perfectly acceptable. Eat, drink, and be merry? Hey, I'm just following the rules here. Between open bars, champagne toasts, and office parties, the month of December was one long pub crawl for me. And if I drank too much, and I always drank too much, I could absolve myself on January 1st. When I swore to a bunch of resolutions I would inevitably break about 2 weeks later. I've made so many false promises on New Year's Day, you'd think I was running for office. But 6 years ago, my party wagon came to a halt. I was tired of embarrassing myself, tired of hangovers. I was 35 years old when I got sober, and though I knew a few things, one question completely flummoxed me. How do you get through the holidays without drinking? I had no idea how to be around people. Cheery people. People with toothy smiles who asked annoying questions like, how's it going? Without drinking. Alcohol was the way I quieted my social anxiety, which basically came down to two issues, my problems with me and my problems with you. Drinking was like a quick phone booth change into the charming extrovert the party demanded. Although as time dragged on, the transformation became a little less heroic and a little more Jekyll to Hyde, which is why I had to give it up. And showing up to the party as me, cranky me, awkward me, made me feel so raw and exposed. In those first shaky months, I would stand at a party, piling my plate with cheese cubes and wondering what to say if someone asked why I wasn't drinking, or worse, tried to twist my arm. Come on, one drink won't kill you. Don't be a buzzkill. I knew a woman who said she was pregnant just to avoid that entire conversation. It's kind of messed up, but we do what we have to do. I crammed my face with squares of medium cheddar, and some people invent hysterical pregnancies. Our culture doesn't make it easy on non-drinkers. Alcohol is the socially accepted way of bonding and easing the stress of our lives. We respond to both depression and jubilation by reaching for a drink, especially in these dark winter months. What nobody mentions about all the holiday spirit is how much booze it requires. Stepping out of that social script can leave you feeling exiled and lonely, like you haven't just lost your crutch, but you've also lost your cool card. Even people who pride themselves on their tolerance can be dismissive of people who don't drink, like they're no fun to have around, as if they're the ones peeing in the potted plants at 2 a.m. I've been surprised over the years by how little consideration is given to the non-drinking guests. They're often a total afterthought. It's like, here we have an artisanal cocktail with muddled mint and cinnamon-infused bourbon. Oh, wait, you don't drink? I think there's some Diet Coke in the fridge, and you can just grab a red solo cup. To be a good host means to consider the needs of your guests. It's normal these days to offer dinner options that are gluten-free or dairy-free or meat-free. I don't see why drinks should be any different. A simple Google search will take you to about 100 different recipes for mocktails. And if that's too much effort, some sparkling water will go a long way. And it's nice to offer those drinks in the same glasses you use for other guests. Downgrading the sober folk to plasticware while everyone else gets crystal goblets is such a weird punishment. As if not drinking weren't difficult enough, now I have to use a cup that announces my difference. What I wanted more than anything was to belong. That's what I wanted from alcohol in the first place, and it's what I was desperate for in the months after I quit. I also wanted to believe that people still liked my company, which was tough at first because I really didn't like my own. But in time, I got used to this new world and more accepting of myself. I still go to holiday parties, although I tend to arrive early and leave when everyone starts talking really loudly. But I don't struggle with that sense of radioactive weirdness anymore. I feel at home in my body and in the world in a way I did not for many years. So if you're struggling to stay sober, hang in there. Because that feeling of comfort, of no longer being racked by shame for who you are or what you did, is a gift the bottle can never give you. But it is a gift you can give yourself.
Sarah Heppala is the author of the memoir Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Our next guest is Maria Semple. Her new comedic novel takes place on one day in the life of its main character, Eleanor Flood. Eleanor is a middle-aged mother who earlier in life had success as the animation director for a popular television show. She was also nominated for a prestigious graphic novel award that led to a book contract. But that was many years ago, and now, having made no progress, she's dodging calls from her editor. She's also worried she's not romantic enough with her husband or present enough with their son, Timby. Timby's unusual name was suggested by an autocorrect error on Eleanor's iPhone. She's decided to get her life together and has created a mantra to say to herself when she wakes up in the morning. The mantra's first sentence is the title of Semple's novel, Today Will Be Different. It's both hilarious and moving to read Eleanor's mostly ungraceful attempts at self-improvement. Maria Semple's also the author of the bestseller Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Before writing books, Semple wrote for television shows, including Arrested Development and Mad About You. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Maria Semple, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your book starts with your character Eleanor Flood's mantra for the day. Can you just tell us a little bit about who Eleanor is?
Eleanor Flood is a woman who lives in Seattle. She's an illustrator. She's the wife of a Seahawks doctor and the mother of a 8-year-old son, Timby. And she is incredibly scattered and overwhelmed by basic daily existence.
Yeah, that sounds fair. So this is her mantra that's trying to be a solution for some of these problems. Can you read it to us?
Today will be different. Today I will be present. Today, anyone I'm speaking to, I will look them in the eye and listen deeply. Today I'll play a board game with Timby. I'll initiate sex with Joe. Today I will take pride in my appearance. I'll shower, get dressed in proper clothes, and only change into yoga clothes for yoga, which today I will actually attend. Today I won't swear. I won't talk about money. Today there will be an ease about me. My face will be relaxed, its resting place a smile. Today I will radiate calm. Kindness and self-control will abound. Today I will buy local. Today I will be my best self, the person I'm capable of being. Today will be different.
That's very funny. I really like the yoga pants reference, that you only wear yoga pants if you're actually going to yoga. That reminds me of a rule in my house where we only try to wear sweatpants if we're actually going to sweat. But of course, it's impossible to keep, because it feels like you're leaving the house in your pajamas.
It does, and it's now getting really frighteningly acceptable, isn't it? Athleisure wear, I think it's called, where they're just owning it out there. Now, no one needs to put any work into it.
So, you know, the novel takes place in one day and actually provides her an opportunity to spend the whole day with Timby. But, you know, because of the plot of the book, she's stressed out and she's distracted. She keeps handing him off to people, sometimes random people at the Gap or people she kind of hardly knows at a sculpture park.
Right.
And it's funny, but I think it gets to this issue that parents really struggle with. You know, they want to be as present as possible for their kids. They want to give the kids their full attention. They want to be the best person they can be for their kids. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're tired, you're cranky, and, you know, oftentimes the children get the lesser version of you and the outside world has grabbed all your attention.
Very much so. And in fact, one of the reasons that I put Timby in the way that I did was that I was looking for a piece of paper one day, and I opened a spiral notebook, and there was a very darling picture that my daughter had drawn of me that said, "Mommy." And it was very sweet, and she signed her name, and she said age 8. And I thought, oh, that's so cute. I'm going to tear this out and put it up on the wall. And directly on the next page was an illustration by her that said Mad Mommy. And it was a picture of me with smoke coming out of my ears looking really mean. And it was like, by my daughter, age 8. And those two illustrations are in the novel, and
right.
I was very happy to be able to put Mommy and Mad Mommy in the novel, and it really just devastated me because I do want to be Mommy, but a lot of times I feel like my daughter gets sloppy seconds, you know, and gets the worst of me every day. And that's not how you want to conduct your life at all. But that often I can see is the kid's experience. And so when I decided to put Timby in the book and I made him age 8 because it was literally the drawing, the age that my daughter was when she drew Mad Mommy, is I wanted to write realistically about a kid who really is getting the worst of his mother. And how sad it is, but also maybe even more sad, is that the kid is not necessarily experiencing it that way. That there's a line in the book where Eleanor says, "I feel like I haven't been spending a lot of time with your dad. I feel like I'm not really there for him." And Timby says, hoping to make her feel better, "That's okay, Mom. That's just the way you are." And he really is trying to help her and thinks that those are comforting words when in fact they just make it worse for her.
So did you, in your mantra with your child, did you try to then play board games or make sure that you were present there all the time?
Oh, absolutely. And Rat-a-Tat-Cat, in fact, makes an appearance in the book because that's a game that I really do try to play. Or Clue, or yeah.
Oh, I hate there. Clue. I can't stand Clue.
I can't either. At some point, I just guess to get it over with.
Yeah, I do too.
Just randomly guess.
So another issue that Eleanor is dealing with, you mentioned it there, is she's struggling in her marriage, and she actually thinks that her husband, Joe, might be having an affair. But, you know, beyond whether or not he is having an affair, if that's actually true, it's clear that they're drifting apart. They don't share a lot of the same interests together. And at one point, Eleanor says, somewhere along the way, my marriage turned into an LLC. Joe and I became two adults joined in the business of raising a child. And, you know, I think that's an issue that a lot of parents struggle with, too, trying to make sure that the relationship doesn't just become about raising the offspring.
That's right. And scheduling just becomes really the basic interaction, I feel, between adults. I remember, I mean, this must have been 10, 15 years ago, the first time a friend of mine said, oh, I'll email my husband. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, how could you admit to something to cross that line? How impersonal. And now I feel like that's really how I interact with my partners. We email each other. And it's terrible, you know, and how at some point you will drift into two people living in the same house together, raising a child. You know, it at some point is easier just to go to things you like alone, and letting them go to the things that they like alone. And that's one of the things that Eleanor is faced with.
And I think then the worry is that once the child leaves the home, then what's left?
Absolutely. The cliche of you've got to put work into a marriage, it just every day you're faced with it. And it is, you have to kind of work on the muscle to like each other and love each other.
Eleanor has a very funny rant comparing herself to younger moms. She considers that she had her child a little older in life. Could you read that passage for us?
When I graduated from college, it never would have occurred to me not to work. That's why women went to college, to get jobs. Get jobs we did, and kick some serious butt while we were at it, thank you very much, until we realized we'd lost track of time and madly scrambled to get pregnant. I pushed it dangerously close to the wire and gave birth to little Timby, thus joining the epidemic of haggard women in their 40s, trapped in playgrounds, slumped on boingy ladybugs, unconsciously pouring Tupperware containers of Cheerios down their own throats, sporting maternity jeans 2 years after giving birth, and pushing swings with skunk stripes down the center of their hair. Who needed to look good anymore? We got the kid. Was the sight of us so terrifying that the entire next generation of college-educated women declared anything but that and forsook careers altogether to pop out children in their 20s? Looking at the Gaylor Street moms, the answer would be, apparently. I hope it works out for them.
That's a very, very funny passage. And I don't know if you consider yourself a younger or older mom, but did you find yourself comparing yourself to younger or older moms on the playground?
Well, I got that idea because I have several friends who are shrinks, and anytime I do, I just say, hey, what's going on out there? Like, what are you hearing about? And one of them, this was maybe 10 years ago, said, oh, here's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing women who had kids and they're old and they're really tired, or I'm hearing about young moms who are afraid of those old moms because they're so terrifying to look at that they have kids and now they're mad that they don't have any careers. And so I just kind of put that back in my head and I thought I'd throw that in the book. But yes, you certainly feel old and tired and judged by the really beautifully put together young moms. And then there's later in the book a big scene with them, and then Eleanor does something quite ghastly to get back at them for being so young and pleased
right.
with themselves.
In your new book, Today Will Be Different, in your last book, Where Did You Go, Bernadette, there are scenes around it, Christian group choirs. And, you know, these are interesting moments because they, you know, your books deal with characters that have like a sarcastic or like an ironic position. They take an ironic position towards the world. But these passages with the choirs are written unironically. And that kind of singing requires you to be unironic and really give yourself up to the singing. And one character says, you know, maybe that's what religion is, hurling yourself off a cliff and trusting that something bigger will take care of you and carry you to the right place. Do you have that kind of a spiritual trust? Do you think of yourself as a religious person?
I wish I had that spiritual trust. I'll tell you that my mother is Catholic, and I was raised Catholic, and my mother still goes to church and really wants me to go to church with her. And for all my years, for 50 years, or at least the 30 years I consider myself an atheist, I would not only say I'm not going to church with you, but I would always kind of mock her and kind of throw an elbow in about how stupid religion was when she went off to church. And then a couple years ago, while I was writing Today Will Be Different, I was in Colorado, and my mother was there. It's where I'm from, Aspen, Colorado. And she said, oh, I'm going to go to church. And my father had just died, and I thought, why do I have to sit here and mock a woman for going to church? And why can't I go to church with my mother? Is this really something I'll be proud of, looking back on my life, that I couldn't go to church with my mother? And so I went to church with her, and I was deeply moved by what I saw there. And in fact, there's stuff that goes on later in the book, which is very much my experience of what happened when I went to church. And I never followed through on it, I will say, you know, but I really at least saw it, convinced me, and I thought it was beautiful.
Eleanor, in your book, Today Will Be Different, was the animation director for a television show, and before she was a mom. And before you became a novelist, you worked for a variety of TV shows, including Mad About You and Arrested Development. And, you know, Arrested Development was such a terrific show about this insanely dysfunctional family. Was there a favorite character that you like to write for?
You know, what comes to my mind first is Will Arnett, because when you're writing for TV, you often will write some really crazy stuff. And I think what's more common than most people would realize is actors come in and say, I'm not going to do that, because it embarrasses them. It would make people think that they're either clumsy or mean or stupid, you know. And so we would have to do a lot of rewrites based on an actor's comfort level. And Will Arnett from day one would just do anything and commit to it, you know. And when you talk to any kind of writer now, and I do still, my friends in TV, and you ask them about actors, and really, if you're saying to someone, do you like that actor, you're not saying, are they a nice person? You're basically saying, how much will they commit to your material? You know, because that's what you love. You love an actor who will just say, okay, point me in the direction and I'll just take it as far as I can, because it's surprising how much pushback you actually get from actors.
Now, your father, Lorenzo Semple Jr., was also a writer. He wrote for television and film. And some of the screenplays he wrote were for the movies Papillon, The Parallax View, 3 Days of the Condor, the 1976 version of King Kong, Flash Gordon, the James Bond movie where Sean Connery comes back, Never Say Never Again. That's the one with the very creepy massage scene in it. And and he also wrote the television show Batman. That's a very impressive list of credits. When you started getting into writing, did your father share any advice with you?
He helped me with scripts. You know, he would go through scripts and give me notes on them. And what he would do was really take the logic seriously of every single scene. And that, I think, is something that's helped me as much as anything, in that he would always say, don't be afraid of rooting it in real life. If someone, oh, I have to get on a plane and fly across the country, maybe at least consider the fact that the plane ticket would be too much because you're buying it on short notice. Or, you know, just always go smaller instead of going bigger. You know, that story solutions happen on a small scale, and don't just immediately revert to, oh, in the next scene they get famous. You know, I try to pull it back into reality, which I know seems weird from the guy who wrote Batman, but he had some other tricks up his sleeve.
So are there any disadvantages in being from a family of writers?
I feel like it's been nothing but positive for me, because as a child, what I saw was that writing was a job, and it was a fun job. I will say that my father always said that he got into writing because his great uncle was the playwright Philip Barry, and he used to spend time with Philip Barry, and he hung out with the expatriates, and it was really quite a heady crowd. And my father always said, wow, that's a life that I would like to do, is to be a writer, because then I can hang out with other writers and drink martinis, and it's would be what a wonderful, elegant way to conduct oneself. And so in my growing up, I was with my parents, who really lived a wonderful life. They traveled all over the world. They brought their kids with them. We always had very interesting people, not just writers, directors, actors around. And I also saw that my father worked really, really hard during the day, you know, and he wasn't to be disturbed. And he, you just saw the look on his face that this guy took it seriously and he worked hard and he was very professional. And so I feel like I came to Hollywood with an understanding of how hard you had to write and how you had to keep at it. And also, I think the kind of disillusionment with Hollywood helped me, in that I liked it, but they were all just people to me at that point, you know, the people I grew up with, the movie stars and the various people. And so it kind of helped that I wasn't starry-eyed from the beginning. I just saw it as work.
Well, Maria Semple, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Maria Semple's new novel is called Today Will Be Different. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Look for the silver lining whenever a cloud appears in the blue.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.